So, welcome everybody. This is the 8th lecture in my course on the Arahant and the Four Truths in Early Buddhism. I hope you can hear me well. There was some discussion on the blog. Part of the discussion was actually on technical problems. It seems that the OLAD site was updated. And so some students had problems accessing the lecture, going onto the blog, and particularly uploading their pictures. I hope most of this problem have been solved. In fact, I've written a note to the administration to ask them if in future they can do such updates after the semester is over. Then there was some discussion on the blog which gave me the feeling that it is perhaps good if I start today by kind of taking a step back from the actual topic that we are discussing to just reflect on what we are actually talking about when I'm speaking about early Buddhism. What is the material that we are using and what is the purpose of this whole study? For that, I have here a little sketch just to give us a very rough historical background to what we are actually doing. The dates I'm giving are highly approximate. They are not meant to be exact. They're just meant to give us a very rough idea. So what you can see here is basically Buddhism in India. From the time of the passing away of the Buddha, around about 400 before the present era, to about 1200 of the present era when Buddhism came to an end in India. And then from India, Buddhism moved to Sri Lanka about, or that should be BCE, I'm sorry, 200 BCE. And the texts that were orally transmitted in India were brought to Sri Lanka together with other texts that are not anymore early Buddhism, like the Abhidhamma. Buddhism continues to develop and to develop, and 300 years later, 100 of the present era, it moves into China. The Chinese translation, the beginning of the translation into Chinese begins. And the lineage, usually we refer to Chinese Buddhism as Mahayana, but actually if you look at it in terms of Buddhist schools, the Vinaya lineage, the monastic rules that were adopted in China are Dharmaguptaka. And then some 500 years later, again, further developments in Indian Buddhism, and what we have at that time in Indian Buddhism is then brought to Tibet, translated into Tibetan. And what we have there is the Mula Savastivada lineage. So basically, these three lineages that you see here are what we still have today. Theravada Buddhism in Sri Lanka and adjacent countries. Dharmaguptaka tradition in China and adjacent countries. And the Mula Savastivada lineage in Tibet and adjacent countries. So what we are taking out, what we are studying here, what we are concerned in this course are the early discourses. This is the shared heritage of all of these traditions. It does not pertain to any of them. And each of them has moved onward. The idea that Theravada Buddhism is the same as what is in the early discourses is not correct. Theravada Buddhism has further developments. And so the whole purpose of what I'm trying to do with this course is to give that perspective of what is the historical earliest layer of Buddhist text, just to have that perspective to see where it started. And of these early discourses, we have four collections preserved in the Theravada tradition. These are in the Pali language, the so-called Pali Nikayas or Pali discourses. Then of the Dharmaguptaka, we have only one collection preserved in Chinese. This is the collection of long discourses. And of the Sarvastivada and Mula Sarvastivada, the two seem to have closely similar or perhaps the same group of discourses, we have two collections preserved in Chinese. One is the one we are studying, the Madhyama Agama, and we have several discourses in Tibetan. So what we are trying to do is we're looking at this transmission of discourses from different schools, looking at what is parallel between them and where they differ. And the paths where they are parallel, this is as far as we can go back in the history of Buddhist thought. So when I say, for example, that in the early discourses, we find a position that is a middle position between realism and idealism, this is not a value judgment of any tradition that takes a different position. This doesn't mean that Abhidhamma is wrong, that Mahayana is wrong, or anything of that type. Each of these forms of thought have their full right to be as they are. I'm only saying, look, this is where it all started. It started off from a position that did not affirm external things to exist in their own right, but also did not see external things as a product of the mind only. And these other positions come out of a dynamic of the development of the Buddhist traditions, which has its inner logic. And for anybody operating within the Abhidharma system, it is very meaningful to see things as having their svabhava, their own, how to translate svabhava, their own characteristic, their own being. And for anybody operating in the Prajnaparamita system, it is very meaningful, or in the Chittamatra, to have the idea that everything is created by the mind. We are not here to create a sutta fundamentalism. This is the only truth. This is right. All the rest is wrong. No. Please don't. That's absolutely not. We are just, I'm trying to see where it all started. And each Buddhist tradition has its full right to develop its own dynamics. This is what makes it so beautiful. The variety, the new ideas. The same is also for a topic that I think took up maybe two lectures ago about samatha and vipassana, insight and tranquility. So when I say that as far as I can tell, in the early discourses, the idea of dry insight is not found because we have an emphasis on the development of the absorptions. But we also do not get the other position where only jhana is given importance and everything else is being put aside. Then I'm just trying to point out a starting point where it all started. I'm not intending to reject the Vipassana traditions. They are wonderful teachers of dry insight, and I have myself learned a lot from them. And I'm certainly not intending to reject those who give emphasis on jhana practice. Again, they are very charismatic teachers and wonderful teachers of jhana. And again, I have learned a lot from them myself. All we are trying to do here is to come to a historical perspective. Each of you is 100% free to have whatever views you like to have, whatever practice you like to do. I'm only intending to introduce the historical perspective, and I only say this and that is not convincing also, meaning not convincing as being placed or presented as the word of the historical Buddha. That's all. We can't be 100% sure what the historical Buddha said, but we can be 100% sure about certain things which he could not have said. And that is important. And that gives a perspective. That's all. I leave some room for questions on this because I think it's an important point that I wanted to clarify. No question, could you? Yeah, then I had given you this homework. I'm just pasting it in briefly for all of us. Identify a problem, What do I contribute to it? Is there an alternative? And what steps do I need to take for this alternative to work? And while in the lecture I was still boasting that as a teacher I don't need to do homework, when I had stopped the lecture I realized that I can't get away as easy as that. And so I tried it right away myself, and I was able to report on the blog that it really worked for me. I was immediately able to realize that I have a problem and that I am contributing to that problem, and I also realized what I need to do in order to diminish that problem. In my case, it's just I'm trying to do too many things. Very simple. And so I don't have enough time. And there were some very beautiful contributions by others. Several did not like to put it out on the blog, and they just wrote to me, which was very nice, but I feel I'm not sure if I'm entitled to share this with others here, so I can't tell you about. But I mean, two on the blog put out their homework. One was Wayne Cho, and she was saying like she has this she would like to meditate, but she found that using guided meditation became too pushy. And so she dropped it for a while and wanted to wait for the situation to develop. And some on the blog then confirmed that that was a very good approach to not push too much. But Juliana also made, I think, the important point that one should also not be too laid back, kind of, and leave it for too far away in the future. And I think that's also correct. I think the thing would be to try to make a basic commitment to formal practice in one's life, but leave the actual practice to be very open and relaxed and receptive. And in that way, I think it would be possible to have that input of formal practice, which I think is important, but at the same time not allow it to get pushy. There was a discussion we had when I was at the retreat. I was in New York at Garrison, and Sharon Salzberg, she was quoting some people who say that there's no need for formal meditation, and you can even meditate in a subway, it doesn't matter. And she's a very sweet person, so she was very accommodating to this kind of position, but I felt I would really reject that. I don't believe in that. I mean, if somebody can do meditation everyday life, that is wonderful, but it doesn't mean that one is free to completely neglect any kind of formal practice. And I do not know anybody who, without doing at least some amount of formal practice, has been able to make substantial progress. Yeah, there's a question here by John Emmer. What do you make of Kalupahana's claim that the Abhidhamma, Nagarjuna, Vasubandhu, Dignaga are properly interpreted as non-essentialist and non-idealist and properly representing the middle position of Buddha, while Buddha Ghosa was no voice of the Buddha and snuck essentialist teaching into the Theravada tradition? Yeah, Kalupahana's claims have not been unanimously been found approval among scholars, and I am not sure if one can really put it so nicely into these two boxes that pretty much Buddha Ghosa got it all wrong and the others got it all right. But I do think that some of the points that we come across in the commentaries systematized by Buddha Ghosa, not necessarily of his own writing, do have a tendency towards a slightly more essentialist or fundamentalist position than we find in early Buddhism. There was another very beautiful example on René van Oosterwijk. In your PDFs, you compare Pali and Chinese text. Do you use any explicit system? If so, which? How do you find the most parallel text? If this fits today's lecture, otherwise please at a later date. Well, the system that I use for comparing is what we call the historical critical method. And for identification of parallels, there's a basic work by Akanuma. I have it here. Chitsun Akanuma's, can you see that? Comparative Catalogue. It's a work written by a Japanese scholar many years ago. He is the first to have made a complete survey of the Pali Nikayas and identify parallels. So this is the basic, the basis for identification of parallels, and then sometimes when we study, we come to a somewhat different conclusion or we find some further parallels. And I have written on the notion of a parallel also in one of the papers that you can download from my list of publications. It's something like Reflection on Comparative Studies, if I remember the title correctly. But the basic method is that of the so-called historical critical method, and that we are aware of the historical development of certain ideas. And the basic assumption we have is then where there is parallel passages in texts of different recited traditions or schools, that it is fairly probable that these are early. And this is an assumption that has been questioned by Gregory Chopin in a paper published in 1985, and which I have been writing a reply to, affirming that this principle is correct, which is about to come out in the Indo-Iranian Journal. And so what is parallel? I think we are on relatively firm ground that this is the common heritage. And when there are differences, then we can evaluate these and see what we are trying to do here in the course. Sometimes internal inconsistencies make it more probable that one is early, the other one is late. Sometimes we just have to leave them standing side by side, like happened with the very first discourse we looked at and these different conceptions of the non-returner. We were simply not sure, the internally fettered, the externally fettered, which one of the two versions has the more correct, the better presentation. At least I simply don't know. Sometimes it just has to be left open. And one important principle that in earlier generations of scholars has sometimes not been seen so clearly is to be aware that this is orally transmitted material. That many of the differences and variations we find are simply the product of oral transmission, of passing on from mouth to ear without having anything to write to fix it. And however much this oral transmission tried to be verbatim correct, to transmit it exactly, inevitably some changes happened. And earlier generations of scholars were sometimes under the impression that any, even the smallest difference, has to be traced back to a conscious editorial decision by the redactors of the text, and must be expressing some bias of the particular school to which that editor belongs. And this is an overinterpretation that simply doesn't work for many of the variations we find. I hope I've been able to give a reply to your very important question. Coming back to the homework, another very beautiful example that I think many of us enjoyed was Meng Hao. He was describing that the problem about getting upset when somebody else cuts you when you're driving a car. And he is now in an environment where this happens more often than what he's used to at home. And he's very put it very beautiful, and I just read it. Maybe I post it in for you. It really touched my heart. Ah, yeah, Kongmu has given the link for the paper. Thank you, Kongmu. So he says, one, dukkha, getting angry when driving. Second cause, me not being able to accept the simply true about the driving etiquette in the Philippines. That is where he's now having this experience. Solution, acceptance, embracing the nature of how things worked here in a different country. Niroda, well, not quite, but I found my anger dropped by 90% to 95% when I'm driving now as compared to before. Yeah, I thought it was really, really beautiful and refreshing. It can be such simple things. And I found myself, as I told you, and many of the participants who wrote to me personally, this kind of making this four truth scheme something very, very practical. And really applying it in one's life, one finds like, hey, wow, it works. Yeah. not always what one would like to hear. I mean, I was not particularly happy of finding out that I was myself the the cause of my own trouble. But yeah, it really makes sense. There's a comment here by Robert. Comment on the homework. I found it difficult that I could not find an isolated problem. When I reflect on one problem, a number of related ones also show up. Probably the best way for me is to follow my intuition and just tackle one problem at a time. Also, maybe it is a good idea to look for things that I can do right now to amend the situation, as in your example. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense, Robert. We were not trying to solve the whole question of all kind of dukkha in one single go. That would be asking a little bit too much. That would be homework for a few years, not for just 1 week when I'm not there. But yeah, the point would be for us to tackle one problem and try out. And it could be a very simple problem like getting angry when driving, or not feeling ready to meditate, or busybody Analayo who is writing 10,000 things at the same time and wonders why he doesn't have time. Just a simple thing and see how this basic structure works. And from trying it out with a simple thing, we get the impression that, hey, there's something to this. It is a meaningful thing. It's not just some strange teaching from 2,500 years ago that one has a lot of reverence for, but somehow of little practical use, but it's something that is actually eminently practical. I remember when I wrote my Satipatthana book and somebody asked me about it, I was confronted with the opinion apparently voiced by several eminent teachers that the Four Noble Truths is something you can't meditate on. No, that's just philosophy. And I felt quite disagreement with that. And I think all those who have done the homework have been able to prove that this is not the case, that it's actually something that can be practically used. And there was a very useful comment by Mark to clarify this what I found nagging about the homework, that I am myself responsible, no? So he says, for me the key point is to own the cause. It is not someone else who made me angry or irritated. As far as dukkha goes, it is all my own show. Nobody else is responsible for my suffering. When I am in a positive, open mental space, I will not react in a negative way to those things. The fact that I am responsible for my dukkha is good news, as the pathway to the cure is not then beyond me and somehow out of my control. I don't have to wait for others to change to soothe my irritation. I thought I was right on the spot. That's exactly the thing. And that is the challenge. The being honest with ourselves. And to see how we ourselves construct our own dukkha. It's not the others. Not that I am. Oh, it's just this university lecture I have to give. If I just stop giving lectures, I'll be perfectly at peace and happy. I just want to be somewhere alone and meditate. Wonderful. No, that's not the problem. The problem is how I deal with things. Do I have mindfulness and clear comprehension in dealing with things? Am I able to stay balanced? Am I able to see negativity coming at me from others, not as a challenge to my ego that I have to defend, but as a challenge to my patience, to which do I have to soften, whether it's angry drivers on the roads of the Philippines or anything else. And that adjustment of perspective, that owning the cause, as Mark puts it so nicely, that makes the whole difference. And there was a comment by Robert on the order. Maybe you remember I had presented this two different orders of the Four Noble Truths. The one that is used by the medical scheme and the one that is used in the Four Noble Truths scheme in Buddhist teachings. Andrew is making a joke again. Haven't they found a tablet for anger yet? They have, Andrew. I'm just presenting it to you. You just have to buy it. So Roberts explains to us that while the order of the diagnostic scheme might have been changed for the Four Noble Truths compared to the original order, usually when things are presented, the most important point stands at the end. When the doctor presents his case solution to the patient, the most important point from the patient's perspective or the general public is that the disease has ceased, as in the traditional order. However, in order to deal with our dukkha, we all have to become our doctors, our own doctors. More important than knowing that there is an end of the disease is the recipe how to get from the sick to the healthy condition. Yeah, I thought that was a very nice point for explaining the shift in sequence between the third and the fourth of the four truths. Yeah, that was what I had on the blog, and if there's any questions regarding what we have discussed so far, then now would be a good time to put them, and otherwise, or after that, we move into Madhyama Agama number 30. Good, then we are ready for Madhyama Agama 30. It's a discourse given by Sariputta, Venerable Sariputta, to the monks. We have read the first part, but I think I go through it one more time just to remind us 2 weeks have passed. Venerable friends, whatever countless wholesome states there are can all be subsumed under the Four Noble Truths. They are all included in the Four Noble Truths. The Four Noble Truths are declared to be the foremost of all teachings. Why? Because they encompass all wholesome states. Venerable friends, it is just as the elephant's footprint is foremost among the footprints of all animals, because it is the greatest, the largest. So too, Venerable friends, the countless wholesome states are all subsumed under the Four Noble Truths. They are all included in the Four Noble Truths. The Four Noble Truths are declared to be the foremost of all teachings. What are the four? They are the Noble Truth of Dukkha, the Noble Truth of the arising of Dukkha, the Noble Truth of the cessation of Dukkha, and the Noble Truth of the path leading to the cessation of Dukkha. Yeah, last time I already mentioned the comments that had been made by Len's cousins and Venerable Jnanaponika Thera on this simile. The simile of the elephant's footprint also occurs in several other discourses in order to illustrate the importance of diligence or heedfulness, appamada. I'm just giving you the references here. And in one discourse to illustrate the importance of the faculty of wisdom. Here's the reference. And the German Indologist Franke, he noted that the image of the elephant's footprint as a simile occurs also in the Mahabharata, where it is used to illustrate the importance of non-violence, ahimsa. So now we get into Venerable Sariputta's analytical approach towards the Four Noble Truths. You will see that he is much more analytical and sophisticated way of dealing with the Four Noble Truths than what I propose to you. He's going to really cut down, and show us a very complex analysis of the Four Noble Truth with a lot of meditative aspects, and I hope it's not going to get too confusing. Venerable Sariputta has this very brilliant analytical mind in presenting things that one really needs sometimes some time to digest the way he is going about it. So I start reading again. What, Venerable friends, is the Noble Truth of Dukkha? It is this: birth is dukkha, old age is dukkha, disease is dukkha, death is dukkha, association with what is disliked is dukkha, separation from what is loved is dukkha, being unable to get what one wishes is dukkha. In short, the five aggregates of clinging are dukkha. What, venerable friends, are the five aggregates of clinging? You see, he's picking out one from the earlier definition and he just goes for that one, which are dukkha. They are the material form aggregate of clinging, the feeling aggregate of clinging, the perception aggregate of clinging, the formation aggregate of clinging, and the consciousness aggregate of clinging. What, venerable friends, is the material form aggregate of clinging? You see, again, he picks out one from the whole thing and goes further. It is whatever is corporeal, the four great elements, and whatever is derived from the four great elements. What, venerable friends, are the four great elements? They are the earth element, the water element, the fire element, and the wind element. Again, he picks out one, no? The earth element now. What, venerable friends, is the earth element? There are, venerable friends, two kinds of earth element. There is the internal earth element and the external earth element. So just to give you a view of how he, this Venerable Sariputta's analysis, so four noble truths, then he goes for the fourth, then within the fourth for the five aggregates, within the five aggregates for the aggregate of bodily form, then the definition for elements, and then he takes up the first element. So it's going cutting down to come to one topic and then to illustrate what this element of earth is about. Now we are going to get a definition of what is the internal earth element. The four elements are representative of basic qualities of matter in ancient Indian thought. Earth stands for solidity, water for anything that is fluid, fire for temperature, and the element of wind for any type of motion. I continue reading. What, venerable friends, is the internal earth element? Whatever internally, being inside the body, is solid and solidified, whatever is internally clung to. And what is that? It is hair of the head, hair of the body, nails, teeth, coarse and fine skin, flesh, sinews, bones, heart, kidney, liver, lung, spleen, intestines, stomach, feces, or whatever else that exists in this body is found inside it, that is solid, solidified, and is internally clung to. Venerable friends, this is called the internal earth element. Venerable friends, as for the external earth element, great though it is, pure though it is, beyond reproach though it is, yet, venerable friends, at times there is an inundation, and then the external earth element disappears. A slight comment aside, when we were translating this, we are not quite sure what is meant by pure and beyond reproach. This is found in the Chinese text, so I can't just delete it, but it's not the three translators of us involved in translating this Madhyama. We are not quite sure what is meant with that. Anyway, continuing with the text. Venerable friends, this external earth element, great though it is, pure though it is, beyond reproach though it is impermanent by nature, of a nature to be extinguished, of a nature to decay, changing by nature. How much more so this short-lived body that is clung to with craving. Yet the unlearned, deluded, worldling thinks, this is me, this is mine, I belong to this. On the other hand, a learned, noble disciple does not think, this is me, this is mine, I belong to this. How could he have such a thought? If people curse him, beat him, and become angry with him, he thinks, this pain that I'm experiencing is born of causes and conditions. It is not without causes and conditions. What are the conditions? It is dependent on context to be experienced as painful. He contemplates this contact as impermanent, and he contemplates feeling, perception, formations, and consciousness as impermanent. Through contemplation of the elements, his mind remains still, one-pointed, concentrated, and imperturbable. So before I go into the dynamics, I have a look. There's a comment by John Emmer. Perhaps the picking of one aspect of each topic and drilling down is intended to suggest the kind of nesting in the way smaller and smaller footprints can fit inside each other within the boundaries of the elephant footprint. Oh, very nice. Otherwise, it strikes me as unbalanced when compared with the systematic presentation of all aspects of each topic. Oh, that's a very nice idea, John. Going for smaller and smaller footprints nested within the big footprint of the elephant's footprint. Yeah. Yeah, I would not have seen it as unbalanced. I think it's just this analytical approach of, like you say, like drilling down to pick out one thing and then illustrate what can be done with even that one little aspect. Very beautiful. Thank you. So I have tried to bring out the basic dynamics of the reflection. See, the thing is that the outside world, it seems so solid to us, all these big mountains and things. But we all know that even the mountains or the big houses have come into being at some point in the past, and at some point in the future they will disappear. In fact, I had that, I told you that I had to go to the States, and it was the first time that I was really in the middle of New York. The flight arrived late at night, and they put me up into one of these very posh hotels. And so early morning, when I got up to do my morning meditation, I pulled aside the curtain, and all the walls of the room were glass. And so all around me, there were all these huge skyscrapers. I was on the 17th floor, and I could see all this. And this is normally something people go for sightseeing, to see that. And it was very funny. It's the first time that I've seen this. But I immediately had this four-element reflection. But, well, it's just Earth, no? Just a half heap of Earth. And down there were these cars moving. Even at 4:30 in the morning, 5 o'clock in the morning, they move. That's just wind element. And they had their lamps on. That's just fire element. And then there was the river on the other side. And that's the water element. Just four elements. 200, 300 years ago, there was just nothing there, and in a few centuries, it might all be gone again. It's very, very interesting to have that kind of reflection, because it, at first, it looks so solid, these huge houses, and one besides the other, and then so and so many stores, and New York, New York. But the real problem then is not so much the skyscrapers or the mountains, it's our own body. We know it changes. We look in the mirror and see it changes, but still it's such a stable reference point for all of our experiences. Since our birth, this is where it all happens. And this is anybody calling my name, here, me. And this kind of stability, that is the, by being a reference point to all of our experience, easily makes us miss the fact that all that there is just a process. It's all changing. And it is precisely this awareness of continuous change which makes this me, mine, gets weakened. If you want to grab onto a stone, and the moment you grab onto it, it turns out to be just a lump of sand, and you touch it, and it just, and you just have a few little bit of sand left, but all of the other sand has fallen to the ground. It's the same kind of, it just dissolves. You can't really fully latch onto it. And realizing that this I, and even just only if it is the body, so much better if we can realize it for the mind, but only realizing this body is just a flow, it becomes easier to flow along with it in a way. Flowing along with things and not trying to freeze things into something that it becomes so solid that we can really grasp it, cling to it. And this is obviously a basic insight, and here the approach is taken from the external Earth being impermanent. According to ancient Indian cosmology, the Earth disappears at some point. But it can also be done by simply observing one's own body, the continuous change that the body is in. And then the logical impact that this insight has in any unpleasant situation is that one realizes that that situation is also impermanent. It sounds very simple, but in the actual situation it makes a huge difference. And it is that precisely which allows the mind to remain balanced, calm, concentrated, imperturbable. It's very powerful. So it doesn't mean that we become like a vegetable that doesn't do anything anymore about the situation, and everything that happens has to be endured passively. When something can reasonably be done, then certainly we will do something about it. But there are sometimes entire situations, or at least aspects of a situation, where one is helpless. And instead of reacting with hatred or aversion, through awareness of impermanence, it becomes possible to remain patient and calm. So here in the situation that we get described, somebody curses him and beats him. If he can stop people from cursing him and beating him, then that's so much the better for them and him. But sometimes that's not possible. And this is what cannot be avoided, we have to deal with it. And it is meant for this kind of situation that this awareness of impermanence is so powerful. And yet not a single cell of that body that was born remains. So I'm nothing. Isn't that something? Yeah, nothing. I think we understand each other, but I think nothing could be misunderstood. It's not that there is nothing there. This is no, it's not a bad joke, Hugdidio. It's interesting. It's a good thing for you to bring that up so that I can elaborate on that point. So not self doesn't mean that there's nothing. That's very often an impression formed of this central doctrine of early Buddhism, which can have quite misleading consequences. There is something, definitely, but that which is there is a process, and that which is there is a conditioned process. But there definitely is something there. I have heard even eminent Buddhist teachers making discourses of the type, like, I mean, applied to my situation here now, it's like, hey, you think this lecture you didn't like it? That's your problem. Can't complain to me. No self. How could I be responsible for that? That would be total rubbish. I am fully responsible for what I'm saying here. And if I didn't prepare this lecture and you come out disappointed, it's my fault. And anatta is no way for me to trick myself out of that. Because I, as a conditioned process, as these five anāryo aggregates that at some point in the past have sat down to think about the lecture, to translate the discourse, that this morning went on the blog and looked at what is there and tried to find something meaningful to say, that is now trying to concentrate and say something meaningful, that is definitely there. And it is my karma, my decision, my responsibility to do the best I can to honor the fact that all of you have come online to listen to me. So it's not that there's nothing, but that which is there is not a solid. There's nothing solid in this analogy. And as you say quite rightly, not a single cell of the body as it is now is the same as nearly 50 years ago when this fellow was born. So I'm very grateful that you brought that up, because that's a very important point I like to emphasize. There's a beautiful passage in Majjhima Nikaya discourse where the Buddha gives a teaching on the five aggregates, and then there's a monk, and it's in the Maha Ochula Punnama Sutta, and then the monk says, anatta katani kammani king attang pusisanti. Karma that's done by not self? What self could they touch? What self could be affected by them? And the Buddha gives him a real sounding. That's a complete misunderstanding. Think that, there's no self, then there's no karma and result. that would be totally missing out the point. Emptiness doesn't mean there's nothing. Not self doesn't mean there's nothing. It means there's nothing permanent. There's nothing substantial. Okay, there we are. Rodolfo Rivas Molina, in the previous lecture you mentioned that there is a causality connection with what you did before, so you are responsible. Definitely, yeah, that's what I'm saying. We are 100% responsible for our intentional decisions, and not self doesn't deny that. It only denies that there is something eternal and permanent. Stuart Corner, nerve cells can last a lifetime. Do they? I didn't know. Lisa Funcott, I like the analogy of the river. We are like a river. Yeah. I love that river image. It's very powerful. Even there is nothing substantial in that river. If you throw poison at some point, the whole river, the fish will die. Le Chan, can you explain more for me about this? The simile of the elephant footprints relates to the inherent meaning of the text. The simile explains that as the elephant's foot combines all petal qualities, so all skilled states of mind are included in the four Aryan truths. Yeah, there were two interpretations that I had mentioned last time. One was by Lance Cousins, where he thinks that the reference is predominantly to meditative states. And by Venerable Jnanaponika, where he says that it includes anything that is wholesome, not only related to meditation. But the image is simply that the elephant's footprint is much larger than the footprint of any other animal. So anything else you can fit into that scheme. That is the basic idea. And this is presumably why the Buddha would have chosen this fourfold scheme to express his own realization when he was giving what, according to tradition, is the first discourse, the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta. It's that it has so much into it. It has that clear distinction between wholesome and unwholesome, which runs like a red thread through early Buddhist teaching. It has that principle of causality. Why is it that I am in craving leading to dukkha? Why is it that there is a path leading to liberation? And it always has this like it has this negative positive side. There is the condition of dukkha, but there's also the path to liberation. So in a way it can be really, and this is how tradition has understood it, as a summary of the entire teaching, the four truths. And it can be used very simple, as some of our colleagues, student colleagues have shown in their homework, as I have been able to see myself in my homework. It can be very simply applied to a single problem, but it encompasses the entire teaching in a way. I hope I have been able to answer your question, as I'm not 100% sure I understood it. Robert, a scientific perspective on the body. I read once that the human body is a community of a trillion single cells, of which many die permanently and are replaced, or not, e.g. skin flakes. Also, the body is composed of countless atoms, a lot of which are replaced every 7 years. Yeah, there's a continuous change in the body, that's true. Juliana, I just remembered that the simile of the elephant footprint is also used for Sankaracharya's teachings, which are said to be like the elephant footprint because they contain all the teachings of the other Vedanta schools. Sankaracharya is of course much later than the Buddha, but this imagery may have been current in Indian thought, yeah. Thank you for sharing. Lisa Fancott, nerve cells may last a lifetime, but plasticity dictates that they will behave and organize and respond differently according to everything we think, we feel, do. The Buddha knew this. Yeah, I don't thank you for explaining that, Lisa, because I don't know exactly about nerve cells. The only thing I know about is that skin cells, because that is part of my daily practice of reviewing the constitution of the body, that I call to mind that what I see from the outside bodies of others and body myself is just that matter that keeps flaking off. It's kind of a and that the outer part, that that's this continuous grease coming out through the pores of the skin to keep it all together from flaking off, and this is an excellent breeding ground for bacteria. There is millions of bacteria on every square centimeter of our skin feeding on what we are on our dead material that's continuously flaking off. I'm sorry. Maybe not the right thing to talk about. I learned yesterday that Mind and Life scientists discovered that meditation affects the behavior of nerve cells. I think it was NMDA receptors. I just learned this from an urology medical student. Yeah, there was a lot of discussion about that at the Mind and Life conference I was, but because I don't know so much about these things, I didn't pay so much attention. Anyway, getting back to our discourse. Yeah, that even being aware of the impermanent nature of the body can be such a powerful tool in everyday situations. And here comes something nice. This is not in the Pali version, but I think it really nicely rounds off the contemplation. If on a later occasion other people come and address him with gentle phrases and soft words, he thinks, this pleasure that I am experiencing is born of causes and conditions. It is not without causes and conditions. What are the conditions? It is dependent on contact to be experienced as pleasant. He contemplates this contact as impermanent, and he contemplates feeling, perception, formations, and consciousness as impermanent. Through contemplation of the elements, his mind remains still, one-pointed, concentrated, and imperturbable. This is very nice, because it gives us the other side also, that awareness of impermanence not only required when we get abused and threatened, but also when we get praises. Oh, you're so wonderful, you gave such a nice lecture, I loved it. Oh, dangerous, danger, danger. ego, oh, big analayo. No. Very careful. Just passing away. Just changing. Now it gets very bad. If on a later occasion some people, young, middle-aged or old, come and subject him to various objectionable acts, perhaps punching him, stoning him, or harming him with blade or cudgel, then he thinks, this body that I cling to is of a coarse material substance, derived from the four great elements, born of father and mother, maintained by food and drink, always requiring to be clothed, needing to sit or lie down, to be massaged and bathed, and to endure the worst. This body is subject to breaking up, extinction, and dissolution. It is because of this body that I am susceptible to being punched, stoned, and harmed with blade or cudgel. Thinking thus, the noble disciple exerts himself or herself energetically, without idleness, with upright body and right mindfulness, without forgetfulness and without delusion, his mind becoming one-pointed and concentrated, or her mind. He thinks, I will not be neglectful. I will exert myself energetically, without idleness, with upright body and right mindfulness, without forgetfulness and without delusion, my mind having become one-pointed and concentrated. This body to which I cling, let it be punched, stoned, and harmed by blade or cudgel. Yet I shall energetically train in the teaching of the Blessed Ones. Venerable friends, the Blessed One has given this teaching. Suppose that bandits have come and are cutting your body limb from limb with a sharp saw. If while those bandits are cutting your body limb from limb with a sharp saw, you were to have some change in your mind state, or even utter evil words, then you would be failing and regressing in your practice. You should think thus: if a bandit comes and cuts my body limb from limb with a sharp saw, there will be not because of that be any change in my mind state, and I will not utter even words. I will arouse compassion towards the person who is cutting my body limb from limb. Yeah, this is a rather stark example, and I think it needs a little unpacking. It certainly does not mean that this should just be allowed to happen if we can in some way prevent it. The idea is only to give an extremely stark example of a very unjust treatment done to us where we are helpless. If we can stop those bandits from cutting our bodies, so much the better. For this sake, I shall imbue my mind with loving kindness and dwell mentally pervading one direction with loving kindness, likewise the second, the third, and the fourth direction, and also the four intermediate directions, and also above and below, all around, everywhere. With a mind imbued with loving kindness, free from fetters or resentment, without ill will or quarrel, I shall dwell pervading the entire world with a mind that is boundless, exalted, immeasurable, and well cultivated. How beautiful, no? From such an extreme situation, now we move over to the practice of metta. The actual practice of metta, loving kindness or maybe benevolence, is not mentioned in the Pali parallel, but it does come in the discourse where we get the simile of the saw. So there is a natural connection, and I personally find this very beautiful. This showing how patience relates to loving kindness or metta. It's another example, the simile of the saw in the Kakachupama Sutta, Majjhima Nikaya 21. It's also found there in the parallels. This is the reference we are getting, the discourse that is being referred to. And there's another beautiful example for patience in the, in the Punavada Sutta, that is 145, fifth discourse in the Majjhima Nikaya. It's this Venerable Punna, he wants to go to a place where people are known to be very aggressive and fierce. And so the Buddha says, what do you do if they abuse you? And he says, well, if they abuse me, I'll think, well, at least they didn't give me a blow. And so the Buddha goes, and if you get a blow, then, well, at least they didn't throw a clod at me. And so he goes on, always imagining something worse that could happen to him, in order to help him maintain patience. And besides the beauty of this sequence, I think it also helps us a little bit to confirm the point, or to support the point I was trying to make before already, that the simile of the saw is not meant to be approving of the fact that somebody is doing some sort of cruel treatment to our body. It is just meant as a very extreme example. So normally in our everyday life, I think none of us has come across the situation of being caught by a band of bandits who then take out a saw and try to cut us into pieces. But having that kind of image in mind, we can compare it to what we are actually undergoing, similar to our friend Punna here. So if somebody is doing this and that to us, we can just think, look, even if this fella would now come and cut me into pieces, I am expected to handle that without getting upset. So how can I get upset about this issue? It's just meant as a kind of comparison to give us a very stark example to inspire us to give that feeling that if I cannot do something about the situation, it's best to stay with it patiently and not react with anger and aversion. It's a question by René. Is to be massaged acceptable for a monk? And I know that some of my friends from the strict forest tradition, they use this foot reflexone massage for healing. So it is practiced among some of the forest monks who are usually very strict with their keeping of their rules, especially for an elder monk to give them a massage on the sole of the foot and to use certain zones to stimulate the organs. This is the practice that I am aware of. Mark, these examples are even worse than drivers in the Philippines. Oh, yes, indeed. I'd rather drive in the Philippines than be in the hand of some of these bandits in ancient India. And it seems the example is not entirely a product of imagination. At least we get the story of Xuanzang, who was apparently caught by bandits who wanted to sacrifice him. They wanted to kill him while he was on pilgrimage in India. But then some kind of miracle happened, and then they got scared and let him go. So it seems there has been something of that kind in India, where there are also other stories we get about, like there's a Samanera who is on the way somewhere and he's being caught and they want to sacrifice him. So this idea of being caught by a bunch of bandits who are going to kill you or cut you into pieces, as far as we are able to tell from the text, apparently is something that indeed happened in ancient India. Juliana Martini says, in the Chinese tradition they teach self-massage to monastics. Yeah, thank you. Stuart Ajahn Suchitto has a great story of when he was on pilgrimage in India and he and his companion were set upon by bandits. His companion ran away, got chased, fell down a precipice and got hurt. Ajahn Suchitto offered his head to one of the bandits with the machete, and the bandit was so confused he stopped what he was doing and Ajahn got away without injury. Oh, how sweet! I didn't know these things even happen in modern times. Yeah, I can't pull out such dramatic kind of stories, but I remember that sometimes, especially in earlier years, when in Germany the seeing of somebody in this kind of somewhat unusual dress that I am wearing as a monk was causing some reactions in people, particularly at the times when everything of this type was associated with Hare Krishna sects and danger and stuff. And so some people would shout at me or things, or try to provoke me, and that always this just simply turning to them, being open but without reacting, would immediately take out that aggression, which needs some reaction, some counter aggression or running away. But these are obviously not as beautiful and dramatic as the story of Ajahn Suchitto there. Thank you for sharing that, Stuart. And Menghao agrees that it's easier to drive in the Philippines than being caught by bandits in India. I think we all agree on that. Yeah, I've one more time highlighted this this patience leading to the metta practice. The two interact. You practice metta in your sittings, you become more patient outside. You become patient, you are able to handle the situation with patience, and the metta comes. Venerable friends, if that monk does not, through recollecting the Buddha, the Dharma, and the monastic community, dwell in equanimity that is in harmony with what is wholesome, then this monk should feel embarrassed and ashamed, thinking, as for benefits, I am without them. As for virtuous qualities, I am without them. For I do not dwell in equanimity that is in harmony with what is wholesome through recollecting the Buddha, the Dharma, and the monastic community. Yeah, I just want to notice that this is quite a different type of recollecting Buddha, Dharma, Sangha than what we are used to nowadays. It's really recollecting what they stand for, what the Buddha stands for, what his teaching stands for, what it means to be a member of his community, be it monastic or, for most of you, lay community, without wanting to in any way discourage or be negative about the standard forms of recollections. To me, this speaks much more to my heart. The standard forms are very powerful also, but I've seen this sometimes become simply the recitation of a particular formula. Iti piso bhagava arhang samma sambuddho, etc., etc. And one does it a number of times. There's even a very eminent monk in Sri Lanka who teaches that one should do it 100,000 times to progress spiritually, which, yeah, perhaps for some it works, but for some, at least those I know, it becomes really just like counting how many times one has done it. And I just wanted you to notice that here we have, excuse me, quite a different approach to the idea of recollection. Recollection of Buddha, Dhamma, Sangha by something where they stand for, and something done without a form of a particular form of recitation, but by behaving in accordance with the principles that these three stand for in a difficult situation. And Pali commentary to the corresponding passage in the Pali Sutta explains that the Buddha is being recollected by recollecting something he's taught, namely the simile of the saw. And the Dharma is being recollected by recollecting this simile, the advice given in this simile. And the Sangha is being recollected by recollecting the virtues of those monks who can endure even such cases of abuse without giving rise to a mind of hate. So the point of this form of recollection is to rouse a sense of urgency, to recall these ideals that for a Buddhist practitioner somehow enliven his or her practice, and to live up to these ideals, to have this commitment to wanting to live up to them by maintaining patience with those crazy drivers in the Philippines. And now we get a simile. I continue reading. Venerable friends, just as a newly wedded wife feels embarrassed and ashamed when she sees her in-laws or sees her husband, know that this monk is like this. He should feel embarrassed and ashamed, thinking, as for benefits, I am without them. As for virtuous qualities, I am without them. For I do not dwell in equanimity that is in harmony with what is wholesome through recollecting the Buddha, the Dharma, and the monastic community. The simile needs also a little unpacking. In ancient India, it was a custom that a wife had to go to live in the family of her husband. So we get this standard situation of the wife that has just been married, coming to a new family where everything is new to her, where she is in a subordinate position. She is subordinate to her in-laws and to her husband, according to ancient Indian situation of a woman. And she has to be very, very careful now to fit into that situation, because that's where she's going to be for the rest of her life. So the situation of this newly wedded wife, which I think Meng Hao would agree is worse than driving in the Philippines, is a symbol for embarrassment and being ashamed and nervous in the ancient Indian situation. Obviously, the Buddha is not approving of this type of situation. He's just picking this out as an example that in the ancient Indian setting would have been well known for feeling for a sense of shame and embarrassment. In fact, Lisa is pointing out that this seems very cultural. Yeah, this is why I am unpacking them. Shame and embarrassment, are they skillful states? They are. Hiri and Ottapa is the Pali terms, Lisa. And they are skillful states because they are even said to be the guardians of the world. If there would not be any sense of shame or any sense of moral scruple, then people would do all kind of things. Not to take them to extremes, but to beware of overstepping the bounds of morality, they have a very important function in the early Buddhist scheme of liberation. If, however, as a result of feeling embarrassed and ashamed, he is then able to dwell in equanimity, that is in harmony with what is wholesome, thinking, this is excellent and peaceful, namely the casting aside of becoming, the abandoning of craving, dispassion, and complete cessation without remainder. He's talking about nirvana. Then, venerable friends, this monk is reckoned to have trained fully and abundantly. See, here we get the pointing to the final goal, that which goes even beyond metta and patience. The total abandoning of craving, dispassion, cessation without remainder, nirvana. So here I have again tried to sketch the dynamics of the reflection. So the recollection of the simile of the saw becomes a recollection of Buddha Dharma Sangha. And that, if that leads to maintain one's mental balance, so much so good. If not, one can use that, these ideals, to arouse a sense of shame, which in this context is skillful, in order to regain one's mental balance. And then the pointer to that which goes beyond that situation, the inclination towards nirvana. Yeah, the same continues to be applied to the other elements, but before that I leave a moment for you to ask any question if this basic dynamics is clear. Good, then we continue with the other elements. John Emmer. Is the sense of urgency to please in Bhikkhu Bodhi's Majjhima Nikaya translation different from the MA sense of shame and embarrassment? I mean, are there differences in the sources or just different choices for translation? Yeah, I would have to look up now the precise Pali phrase and the translation, but since you put the to please in square brackets, and I also do not remember to have seen something like this in the Pali version, I suppose it's just sense of urgency which is in the actual text, and in this case there would be no basic difference between the two. Yeah, if the square brackets are Bhikkhu Bodhis, then this means the to please is something that he has added to the text to make the translation more clear. And then in this case, there's no basic difference. It's just a difference in a slight difference in terminology. The basic point would be the same. No, you're most welcome, John. What, venerable friends, is the internal water element? Whatever internally inside the body is watery, moistening, and is internally clung to, that is to say, brain, brainstem, tears, sweat, snot, phlegm, pus, blood, fat, marrow, spittle, bile, urine, or whatever else exists internally, excuse me, inside the body, that is watery, moistening, and is internally clung to. This, venerable friends, is called the internal water element. Yeah, the reference to brain and brainstem strikes some of us maybe as unexpected. And I think the Ekotarika Agama puts brain and brainstem under earth element. it seems for some reason in these listings, in fact in the Pali version, we do not get brain and brainstem in this listing. So it seems brain and brainstem were added and then sometimes added in different places, either under earth or under water element. Venerable friends, as for the external water element, great though it is, pure though it is, beyond reproach though it is, yet, venerable friends, at times there's a conflagration and then the external water element disappears. And then after this we get this whole meditative dynamics that we have been through with the earth element. And Juliana has just checked and the Pali has sung Vega. So, yeah, then we come to the fire element. What, venerable friends, is the internal fire element? Whatever internally inside the body is fiery, warming, and is internally clung to. That is to say, that by which the body is kept warm, that by which one becomes feverish, that by which one becomes hot and sweaty, that which gives strength, that by which food and drink are digested, or whatever else exists internally inside the body that is fiery, warming, and is internally clung to, this, venerable friends, is called the internal fire element. Yeah. Venerable friends, as for the external fire element, great though it is, pure though it is, beyond reproach though it is, yet there is a time when the external fire element arises, and having arisen, burns villages, towns, mountain forests and wilderness. And having burned these, it reaches a road or reaches water and becomes extinguished for lack of fuel. Yet, venerable friends, after such conflagration, people seek to make fire by means of drilling wood or bamboo or by striking a flint. And we get again the whole meditative dynamics. Marx says, the brain has the consistency of tofu, so it could be put either in water or earth. I don't know what kind of tofu you get in Sri Lanka. The tofu we get in Taiwan is not like brain. Fortunately. Sorry for making silly jokes here. Yeah, I mean, it's actually interesting in so far as it brings us to try to understand what these four elements are about. I mean, everything, even meat, has some fluid aspects to it. Even the bones, even the skin. So it seems that, as you rightly say, the distinction between earth and water is somewhat fluid. And we could put it in one or the other category, but the import of the elements is really something that is on the surface level evident as, oh, this is solid, or this is fluid. It is quite different from the perspective adopted in the commentarial tradition, which does inform some of the Vipassana traditions of modern day, where the four elements are used for an atomic contemplation. Again, as I said at the beginning, this in no way is a form of criticism of these Vipassana traditions, just simply trying to point out that the conception of the four elements as atomic qualities in the way this informs particularly Vipassana traditions coming from Burma is not the same as the four element conception that we find in early Buddhism. So, going from tofu back to the wind element. What, venerable friends, is the internal wind element? Whatever internally inside the body is airy, moving, and is internally clung to. That is to say, upgoing winds, downgoing winds, winds in the bowels, coursing winds, pulling and contracting winds, stabbing winds, pushing winds, circulating winds, winds in the limbs, out-breath, in-breath, excuse me, or whatever else internally inside the body is airy, moving, and is internally clung to. This, venerable friends, is called the internal wind element. Venerable friends, as for the external wind element, great though it is, pure though it is, beyond reproach though it is, yet there are times when the external wind element arises and, having arisen, knocks over houses, uproots trees and causes landslides. When it encounters a mountain or the face of a cliff, it stops and becomes still. Yet, friends, when the external wind element becomes still, people seek to make wind by using a fan, a palm frond or a cloth. So the ancient Indian notion of winds as something to some extent similar to the notion of qi that we know from Chinese, especially those of us who practice Tai Chi are familiar with. And many diseases are also related to wind, an unbalanced of internal winds and the whole motion of the body, like the fact that I'm now moving my tongue is because of the tongue as earth element and the motion as wind element. The wind element is responsible for this kind of motions. And now we get the element of space. When we're friends, just as when a space is enclosed by timber, clay and reeds, it comes to be termed a house. So too, when we're friends, it is with this body. Know that when a space is enclosed by sinews, bones, skin, flesh and blood, it comes to be termed a body. When we're friends, if internally the eye sense space is not intact, and if external forms are not illuminated by light, so that no awareness occurs, then eye consciousness does not come to arise. He's now going for sense experience. Venerable friends, if, however, internally the eye sense space is intact, and if external forms are illumined by light, so that awareness occurs, then eye consciousness comes to arise. Venerable friends, the internal eye sense space and form, that is, the external form is cognized by eye consciousness, belong to the material form aggregate. You see how it's working up back? First became Four Noble Truths, five aggregates, first aggregate, and now he's working back up. Any feeling that thus comes to be belongs to the feeling aggregate. Any perception that thus comes to be belongs to the perception aggregate. Any volitional formation that thus comes to be belongs to the volitional formations aggregate. Any consciousness that thus comes to be belongs to the consciousness aggregate. This is how one contemplates the conjunction of the aggregates. Venerable friends, the Blessed One has also given this teaching. If one sees dependent arising, one sees the Dharma. And if one sees the Dharma, one sees dependent arising. Why is that? Venerable friends, the Blessed One teaches that the five aggregates of clinging, the material form aggregate of clinging, the feeling aggregate of clinging, the perception aggregate of clinging, the formations aggregate of clinging, and the consciousness aggregate of clinging arise from causes and conditions. Same is then applied to all of the other sense doors. The saying by the Buddha that seeing dependent arising, one sees the Dharma, is not preserved for us as a discourse on its own, but only in this indirect quotation. Nevertheless, it is a very powerful statement that really points to the essential role that dependent arising plays for an understanding of the Dharma. And as we see illustrated here, the point is not necessarily to go for the entire 12 link presentation, which has its value and right, but to apply it directly in one's own experience. We saw it applied earlier where the person who is facing abuse and even maybe being hurt physically simply reflects that, look, it is because of the body that I am prone to experience such things. It is always this looking for causes and conditions, which is also so crucial in your homework in the Four Truths. Always looking for the causes and conditions. Yeah, so I'm just here listing how he's been moving back again from dealing with each of the four elements individually, come back to what is the aggregate of bodily form, and then take up the six senses, come to the five aggregates, and then this final pointer to dependent arising. Yeah, I think we have a little time. No. Yeah, this is a rather complex discourse, and maybe as there's only a few minutes left, I just leave time for questions instead of rushing on to the next discourse, because I believe, in fact, originally I was planning to discuss this discourse as the last before going away for 1 week to give you time to digest it. So maybe I'll stop my presentation here with all these very complex dynamics that this discourse has presented, and we turn to the next discourse, Majjhima. Oh no, there's still something there, I'm sorry. Yeah, there's still something there. Yeah, there's a little, that fits in well. But anyway, we leave Majjhima Agama 31, which is again on the Four Noble Truth. We leave that for next time. So before I continue, let me see, there are some comments here. Shame and embarrassment. My feeling is that shame and embarrassment do not lead to harmony of the mind as such, as these are negative states of mind, a feeling of inadequacy. They make me more alert, I increase my energy and dedication, and then often the practice improves as a consequence. However, this can lead to a cycle where the progress feeds on negativity. I wish I could more often get the energy out of the joy of practice or joy of recollecting one's virtues. I think this is the goal. Then following the path becomes truly effortless. Yeah, Robert, I think the issue of shame and embarrassment in a Western setting might be somewhat different from its original teaching context in India. They are not meant to lead to negativity, which is maybe what we more easily associate with shame and embarrassment, while Lisa before had asked if these are actually wholesome states. But in the context of the early Buddhist teaching, Hiri and Ottappa do not mean to roll in negativity, but do mean conscious, kind of a sense of conscience that certain things are not appropriate to be done. So I think we need to separate out these two. If it is rightly used, if it is appropriately used, it can be a help on the path. But I do see your point that just speaking bluntly about shame and embarrassment it sounds like being negative towards oneself, and that would not be useful. Mark, did I understand right that this statement, if one sees dependent arising, one sees the Dhamma, is attributed to Sariputta, but not directly to the Buddha? Well, Sariputta quotes it as a saying by the Buddha, but at least in the Pali canon, I'm not aware of a passage where the Buddha is directly shown to have said this. Lisa, I agree with Robert and think maybe that the English translation of Hiri and Ottappa are loaded with negative meaning, whereas in the teaching they are meant as gods. Exactly. Thank you, Lisa. That was exactly the point. René, in the beginning of the discourse I saw that not all truths were called noble. Does that differ in different traditions? Could you imagine a different translation such as of the noble one? Yeah, René, this is precisely the topic that I'm going to take up in relation to the next discourse. In some tradition, they are not called noble. But in fact, that was just what I was thinking about, that getting into the next discourse now squeezes too much into the last minutes. So we leave that for next time. Okay, I read the last part of the discourse. One who contemplates this becomes disenchanted with past, future, and present manifestations of the five aggregates of clinging. Being disenchanted, he becomes dispassionate. Through dispassion, he becomes liberated. Being liberated, he knows he is liberated. He knows as it really is. Verse is ended. The holy life has been established. What was to be done has been done. There will not be another existence. In the Pali version, we get a slightly different ending. It comes back to the Four Noble Truth topic. These five aggregates of clinging are dependently arisen. The desire, indulgence, inclination, and holding, based on these five aggregates of clinging, is the origin of suffering. The removal of desire and lust, the abandonment of desire and lust for these five aggregates of clinging, is the cessation of suffering. So I think the main point of this discourse is to show a rather complex but very practical application of the Four Noble Truths. And here I have the all-over dynamics of the reflection. So we started off with the impermanent nature of the earth element, apply this to the body, then see that any unpleasant or even pleasant experience is impermanent. The mind remains imperturbable with this, and we become able to patiently bear with what others may do. And out of this patience arises metta. And this form of practice is a way of recollection. By recollecting the simile of the saw, it becomes a recollection of Buddha, Dharma and Sangha. Then there's the sense of shame. If one is unable to maintain mental balance, and if one is able to maintain mental balance, one is inclining towards nirvana. That's the right word on which to close this lecture, I think. Thank you very much for your attention, for your interesting questions and comments. I look forward to learning from the discussion on the blog and to seeing you again next week.